It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. Coming up here on Central Time, New York Times food writer Mark Bittman joins us for Food Friday with some of his favorite recipes for great food cooked fast. First, the country saw protests from coast to coast this week after a St. Louis County prosecutor announced Monday that a grand jury decided not to indict police officer Darren Wilson. Wilson shot and killed unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in August of this year. That shooting sparked protests in August that attracted national media attention, continued for months. After the decision was announced on Monday, protests broke out in Ferguson and communities in other U.S. cities followed suit. Here in Wisconsin, there were rallies on Tuesday in both Madison and Milwaukee. The focus of the demonstrations around the country has been the relationship between law enforcement and the black community. Wisconsin has the highest rate of black male incarceration in the country at 13%. That's about double the national average. We've got two organizers of protests here in Wisconsin joining us now. Brandi Grayson is in the studio. She's the founder of the Madtown Community Response Team. She organized a rally here in Madison. Brandi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Lavelle Young is president of the Black Student Union at UW-Milwaukee. He organized a rally of students over there. Lavelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, how you doing, Rob?
And then also Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, is with us. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Hey, glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So, Brandi, let's start with you. First of all, what was your initial reaction when you heard that grand jury decision earlier this week?
Well, we were not surprised. I think we all were expecting that decision that Officer Wilson would not be indicted. There's been a lot of questionable things happening in terms of the investigation of the murder of Mike Brown. So we lost faith in the justice system in Ferguson and their ability to be non-biased when it came to reviewing the evidence regarding the murder.
And now you organized a rally at the jail here in Madison through the Young, Black, and Gifted Coalition. What was the main message of the rally?
Well, our main objective was to stand in solidarity with Ferguson and to bring to light the fact that Ferguson and the murder of Mike Brown is just a microcosm of what is taking place across the nation in terms of the state violence that is happening towards black people, and the fact that as a country, as a society, we are watching it happen without really paying attention to it. We see it happening, and we see black men being murdered and incarcerated at ridiculous rates, but somehow we excuse it and we regurgitate the narratives that are fed to us by mainstream media without understanding the root of it. And the root of it is racism, institutionalized racism. And we don't like to talk about that. And no one wants to discuss what racism really looks like. Most of us believe that racism is a conscious hate, something that you are aware of, and that only those who consciously say, I hate black people, I hate people of color, are racist. But that's not true. Racism is a complex system of social and political levers and pulleys set up generations ago to benefit or working on the behalf of whites at other people's expenses. And I think it's important that we have that dialogue. It's an insidious cultural disease, and it's going to continue to spread like a virus until we dig up the roots of it and we're honest about it. We breathe in racism the minute that we're born, and we are not all born with hate, but because of the way the systems are set up, it rears its ugly head anytime a white person interacts with a black person within that system or even on an individual level. And it really doesn't care if you like black people, if your grandchildren are black and your best friend is black. It is what it is. And we have to scoop it out. And white people have to scoop it out every day by just being self-aware of what it really looks like and how it manifests itself. And it's not just manifested in hate. It's manifested in privilege. It's manifested in apathy. It's manifested in all sorts of ways. Ignorance. It goes on and on. So I think Ferguson really, it's just a microcosm of what's happening in our nation. And we organized a rally to say we will not stand for it anymore. We will not accept status quo. We will continue to organize actions in Madison's around the mass incarceration of black people and black men specifically. And we will be out in the front line on a weekly basis.
I want to go to Milwaukee now with Lavelle Young, organized an event, a rally in Milwaukee. Lavelle, what was the message? Similar to what Brandy was saying here in Madison, were you targeting similar things in Milwaukee?
Yeah, basically. I mean, and to get things straight, like really quick, I wasn't maybe the lead organizer of it. There were multiple different student leaders at our campus that helped organize this event. And it's pretty much we share the same desire to get the message out, not only, like I said, to call to the national attention to it, but also to our campus and our campus faculty members and our campus students to let them know that Milwaukee, we're right here and we're facing the same issues that Mike Brown's family faced and over there in Ferguson. And so pretty much, yeah, that we want to share the same message that Brandy is expressing, that, you know, like the coming to Dontre Hamilton, who was slain by a police officer at Red Arrow Park downtown. We're still awaiting from our district attorney's office a verdict, or not a verdict, but if that officer is ever going to be charged. And so we're constantly marching and we're constantly sharing the same rhetoric that we continuously hear around the nation. And Milwaukee and Wisconsin is pretty much one of the main offenders of this system that incarcerates, as you stated earlier, a high, very high percentage, almost double the nation's average of African-American males.
Now, Michael Johnson with Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, you had encouraged rallies and demonstrations earlier this week. You specifically encouraged peaceful demonstrations, avoiding any kinds of violence. In Ferguson, we saw at least some portion of the protesters turning to violence. What do you want to see when it comes to demonstrations and rallies? What kind of messages do you want to hear? What kind of actions do you want to see?
Yeah, I think it all comes down to what we do across the country. I think our local elected officials and the people who are decision makers need to make sure that we invest in our young people. One of the reasons why I went down to Ferguson was, one, to make sure that Mike Brown's parents knew that that the state of Wisconsin, and particularly Dane County, that we were there to support them. And that's why we raised a significant amount of money to make sure that Michael Brown's siblings went to college, and then our community raised $20,000 to support the family as well. What I would like to see is, when you look at across large urban municipalities, young African-American males are not graduating from high school at the same rate of their white counterparts. So one of the things that we did in Madison through Boys and Girls Clubs and our partners is to start a program called Avid Tops that focus on reaching out to young students of color, first in their family to graduate from high school or to go to college, and we have had some significant success in that. The reality is, if you don't empower these young men, if you don't educate them, if you don't prepare them for either college or careers, they're going to be stuck in poverty. And there was a study that was done by UCLA. We know across this country, if you educate young men and women, there's a return on that investment. For every young man and woman that don't graduate from high school, you and I as taxpayers will pay $200,000 over that young person's lifetime, because they're going to become dependent on public resources. And for every school district that increase their graduation rates by 10%, you can reduce crime in your community by 10%. Now, I want to see issues around mass incarceration decrease. I want to see more money spent on educating our kids. When we live in a country and we spend $40,000 a year to incarcerate an adult, but we spend $5,000 a year to educate a child, there's something fundamentally wrong with that, and we have to change that. So these issues have been going on for decades. And I think what I get frustrated about, particularly in the community that I live in, there's a lot of people that want to help, but we have to go beyond the conversation. We have to get beyond the studies and actually invest in our young people and create targeted programs to make sure that they're thriving, and to make sure that we're not locking them up, and to make sure that we're supporting them so they can aspire to do great things in this country.
Now, Brandy, one thing we've been talking about since August, really, and beyond, is the relationship between police on the one hand and minority communities on the other. How would you paint a picture of Madison and the Madison area when it comes to that relationship?
Well, I would say that it's a relationship that struggles. Because, again, we're locked up at the highest rate across the country. We outrate Ferguson. We outrate Mississippi. And that says a lot in terms of the relationships of the Madison Police Department, as well in relations to communities of color. There is no relationship, really. I mean, out of all the police officers I've had encounter with, I have to say, and I've been here since I've the age of 10, and I am now 35 years of age. So I've been here 25 years, and I've only encountered maybe three police officers that dealt with me in a human or humane way, meaning that when they approached me, whether I was in the wrong, whether it was speeding or my back brake lights were out or my license plates were suspended for whatever reason, I only encountered three police that handled me in a humane way. And that says a lot, because I've had many interactions with police officers, and I've been immediately just regarded as, I felt like I was being talked at. I felt like I was being dismissed, disregarded as a person in a lot of those encounters. And I've also experienced being pulled over without due reason and having a police make up the reason for pulling me over. For example, I had one incident when I was pulled over and they said, well, your license plates did not match your vehicle, which, of course, was a lie. And then his response was, oh, it must have been a glitch in the computer system, which, of course, was a lie. And then I've had encounters where I've been pulled over and said that I looked like or my vehicle matched the description of, and I had one encounter where police pulled me over with guns drawn right on Badger and Park Street. So that says a lot. And I am a single Black woman, and I do not have a criminal record. I do not. I have never done. I haven't broken a law in my life. So that just says a lot about how what approach the police department uses. And we have to figure out a better way, you know. And a lot of times, again, it's that word that we hate to use, and it's the word that we hate to be to uproot, and that's racism. It's in the training, it's in the policy, it's in the system, it's intertwined in the system. We have a history of the Justice Department being directly involved in the oppression of people of color. That is something that's been passed on from generations to generation, and it affects everyone. It's like a virus. So even if a police officer said, I'm not racist, I have this, I'm a good person, I uplift everyone, we have to really look at the system that we're involved in. Even teachers, I mean, our education system is set up not to educate our children, because there is a understanding and a stereotype that our children are inferior by nature, that we are innately DNA genetically coded to be not as smart as our counterparts, which is a lie. But what ends up happening in those classroom settings is our children feel the disengagement of their children. They feel the low expectations, and their response is, then what is my point? Why do I put forth the effort? And they start to feel less than. They start to feel hopeless. And that's the same thing that happens when our police officers interact with people of color. And most people don't even believe that cultural diversity training is necessary. And even if there is cultural diversity training in Madison, I believe they're only required between two and five hours a year. And what is that? And what does that mean? And what does that look like? Checking the box that's saying that I understand what a Black person looks like. Does it really talk about and really, really get to the root of what is causing the profiling? What is causing the negative interactions between a police officer and a Black person? We don't want to talk about it. And then we have a lot of leaders and a lot of people in charge that have titles and positions that don't want to talk about it either, because their title and their position is intertwined with the funding of their university, or I mean, not the university, of their organization or other programs. And my coalition and my organization and the people that I work with, we're tired of it, because it just leads to more conversations and more conversations and non-actions. We need actions. We need change. The Madison Police Department needs to be held accountable. Sheriff Mahoney needs to be held accountable. Our chief of police needs to be held accountable. There are changes that must happen immediately. We cannot wait 5 years or 10 years for studies to come out to say that, oh, yeah, this is true. We know it's true. We know there's a problem. Let's address it.
We're talking about Wisconsin's response to the announcement Monday that a grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri, decided not to indict police officer Darren Wilson. We have Brandi Grayson and Lavelle Young both involved with rallies in Madison and Milwaukee, respectively, this week. Also, Michael Johnson on the line, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post in the Central Time Facebook page. Are the concerns in Ferguson also concerns in Wisconsin? This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our panel discussion about Wisconsin's response to the announcement Monday that a grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri, ruled not to indict police officer Darren Wilson. We have Brandi Grayson with us, founder of the Madtown Community Response Team, Lavelle Young, president of the UW-Milwaukee Black Student Union. They're involved in organizing rallies in Madison, Milwaukee. Also, Michael Johnson is with us, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Let's go right to a caller. We've got Jovan in Milwaukee. Jovan, am I saying that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What you want to bring up, Jovan?
My question is geared towards Brandi, actually all three. I wanted to know, what is the importance of being a Black person and actually building a Black culture? Because Raven recently was on TV, Raven Simone. I don't know if you guys seen that. And I think that's a big conversation going on as well, about us actually assimilating into just being American and not actually acknowledging our African roots. I want to know, what is the importance of African culture and why is it even needed?
Jovan, thanks. Great question. Lavelle, let's bring you in on that first. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's important to recognize that, you know, we're all here in America and that we all came from diverse backgrounds. America is the melting pot. America is a nation of immigrants. And so we need to understand that we all come from diverse backgrounds. And we all are here as Americans. And what unites us is that we're citizens. And what should unite us is that we all have equal rights as a citizen and shouldn't be treated differently because of our culture, our background, our heritage, and things like that. The reason why it's important for us as African Americans to embrace our heritage and not just denounce it and just call ourselves Americans is because I believe that's what the system wants. That's what the system has been designed to do. You know, to kind of piggyback off what Mr. Johnson said about like, you know, students and they need to graduate from high school and you know, get into college and we need to spend more money on our education system versus our prison system. Like that's completely understandable. And if you look at the data, like, you know, it's very disproportionate. But we also need to refocus on the fact that, like, you know, it's the intertwined racism that, you know, Brandi is talking about that is ingrained in our system and in our American culture. So, you know, because I'm African-American male, I'm going to make sure I embrace my heritage and I want the rest of the nation and the rest of the world to also embrace it and not look at it as a threat to this nation, not look at it as a difference, and I'm supposed to just denounce it, you know. And that's what I feel as Raven did it necessarily in that interview, and I think that's something that anybody from any background, whether they're Indian, whether they're Caucasian American, like you should embrace your heritage and your ancestry and things like that, and you should hold on deep into it, and you shouldn't want to denounce it because society feels threatened by your heritage.
Jovan, thanks a lot for the call. I'm sure you've all got answers to that. We've only got a few minutes left. And Michael, I wanted to throw something at you with our guests here today, with the rallies you're seeing. Do you see a new generation of organizers, of people getting involved in issues like this, maybe sparked in part by what happened in Ferguson?
Yeah, I think it's, I met with Brandi and her group, but also met with groups like the NAACP and the Urban League and United Way and other groups who have responded. I think it's important that we hear from our emerging leadership in communities all across the country, but I also think it's important that these various groups meet and figure out a way to organize, because we have to get past the rallies, we have to get past the protests, and we need a systemic plan for how we make sure that we take care of communities that are struggling, particularly the African-American and also the Latino community. And so these issues, again, has been going on all over the country for years. And where we always fell short is we have to figure out a way to influence policy, we have to figure out a way to make sure that we get resources to those communities who are struggling. And I welcome young people who are out there protesting. My only message to them, and I think Brandy and her team did a great job, you know, last week, is Mike Brown family asked that we protest, but we not use acts of violence to communicate our concerns. And I think when people start looting, when people start setting things on fire, when people start using derogatory terms, it takes away from the message. And at the end of the day, I think we have to figure that piece out as a community. To address the question from your caller, I think we I'm African-American, and I am proud to be an African-American who grew up in some of the toughest public housing developments on the west side of Chicago. I stayed in a public housing development called the Avalon Homes and also Cabrini Green. I'm proud that I grew up in those neighborhoods, and I understand my history. I understand what our people are going through, and we have to make sure that our young kids understand who they come from and where we're trying to go.
All right, I've got to jump in. Time has flown. Thanks to everyone who joined us for this conversation. Much more we could have gotten into. Full phone lines. Apologies to the callers on hold. I think we'll pick up these issues again over the next week, month, year, probably. We've been speaking with Brandy Grayson, founder of the Madtown Community Response Team, Lavelle Young, president of the UW-Milwaukee Black Student Union, also Michael Johnson, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. You can continue the conversation at the Central Time Facebook page. Stick around, more to come, including Food Friday here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back with me on Monday. It's Food Friday. Thanksgiving is over. Maybe you're exhausted from all the prep and the cooking went into the big feast. Maybe you're done with cooking for now. Too much work. Nobody has time on a work week. But wait, Mark Bittman, the author of the best-selling How to Cook Everything series, joins us with a fresh and fast take on cooking great food. He's a New York Times food writer, host of a PBS food series. Mark Bittman's new book is How to Cook Everything Fast. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, I laid it out a little bit there. A lot of us are juggling work, cooking for the family. Maybe we don't make time for food. So why this book on cooking fast?
Well, I think, you know, what I've found since I wrote the original How to Cook Everything is that people have basically two... Well, I guess the best word is excuses for not cooking. One is they say they don't have enough time, and the other is they say they're afraid or they don't know how to do it. And I, you know, I tried to address both of these in How to Cook Everything Fast. The recipes are not only fast, obviously, but it's more than a collection of fast recipes. It's a sort of rethinking of the recipe so that anyone who takes the time and trouble to have the right ingredients can walk into their kitchen and turn on the stove and start cooking right away and get walked step by step through a recipe that's going to work. And it's a little hard to explain without visual cues, but the recipes look unlike other recipes.
Well, I was going to say that, and this is not usually the most exciting part of a cookbook, but the format is different. Can you break that down and explain a little bit about what you tried to do with the format to make our cooking more efficient and faster without sacrificing the awesomeness of the food?
Nicely put. You know, we at the beginning, I got together with a team of people, and two were designers, and two were editors, and two were recipe writers and cooks, and then me. And we said, what's the dance? What's it look like when you watch people cook, and how can we describe that to non-cooks? Because current recipes don't do that. Current recipes are these weird blocks of texts that, you know, you have ingredients on the left, and it would make you think that you're supposed to assemble all your chopped onions and sliced tomatoes and minced garlic and picked parsley and so on before you start cooking. But, of course, when you look at how real cooks do it, what they do is they walk in the kitchen, they put a pan on the stove, they turn on the fire, they put some olive oil in the pan, they mince some garlic, they put the garlic in the oil, then they chop up some chicken, and then so on and so forth. And that's what we do. We go through the recipe step by step as if you were cooking it. So, you know, there's always, I mean, cooking is the application of heat to food. While that heat is transforming the food from one thing to another, there's time. You always have to wait. Mm-hmm. There are no zero-minute recipes. So while you're waiting for the olive oil to warm or the garlic to turn blonde or the tomatoes to break down or the chicken to brown or whatever it is, there's always time to do other things. And that's what real cooks do. They put something in the pan and then they get the next thing ready. It's not a get everything ready and then start cooking. It's a cook and prep at the same time. And that's how our recipes are broken down. There's cook and there's prep and there's cook and there's prep and so on down the line.
And then it's laid out real simple. The cooking, you know, turn on, you know, preheat oven or turn on the thing, black text. So while that's going, blue text, chop your garlic or whatever the step is so that it leaps out at you. Okay, I'm waiting for this thing to warm up. I can use this time efficiently to do something else now.
That's perfect. And it is two color in black and blue. And, it makes it real easy if you want to cook with someone else because you can say to them, you do the stuff that's written in blue, I'll do the stuff that's written in black or vice versa. And you already have a perfect division of labor. But it, it's also real clear what you should be doing when. You know, this is a sort of an in-joke among cookbook writers, I guess, but one of the most frequently used words in recipe writing is meanwhile. And we determined we were not going to use the word meanwhile in this book because once you read the word meanwhile, you have done everything that you were supposed to have done meanwhile. But, yeah, anyway.
Well, let's step back a bit before we get into more of the hows of cooking fast. Let's get into the why, because a lot of times, like, okay, I don't have much time. I'll open a can of something. I'll make a sandwich. I'll pick up the rotisserie chicken. I'll call takeout. What's the advantage of not doing those things I just listed?
Well, I think the primary reason to cook is that you have control over what you eat, and that once you relinquish that control, you really don't know what's going on. So all the things you just mentioned, I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of them, you know, but if you start to rely on that, you're basically outsourcing how you're fueling your body, how you're replenishing your body. And, you know, I myself would not want to relinquish that much control. And it's only cooking, it's only preparing food by yourself that really gives you full control.
And what are the benefits, then, of that control, of not, as you say, outsourcing our food preparation?
Well, the benefits are that you start with ingredients that are real food. So that if you look at the spectrum of what's sold in the supermarket, you might say 60, 70, or 80% of that stuff is not even real food. So if you want to eliminate things that have 30 ingredients and have... And then some of them are pretty strange, and we don't know what they are, and so on down the line. You need to stick to the things that really don't have labels, or they have labels with no ingredients on them, or three ingredients on them. And that's the universe of real food, and that's, I think, where more and more people want to live. And only by cooking do you really get to live in that universe.
So let's get to a point before we even hit the cutting board and turn on the oven. You look some at our pantry, what we should have, where we should have it. What are a couple of key ingredients that we should have on hand near our cooking zone?
You know, I think in a way, a good pantry has, you know, 150 ingredients in it. I mean, it's not, you know, the key things, obviously, the olive oil, lemons, Parmesan, soy sauce, vinegar, so on down the line. But when you think about it, if you're going to cook, depending on how many flavors you like and what kind of flavors, it really helps to have dozens, if not hundreds, of things in the pantry. That doesn't mean that you need to go out and buy 150 things tomorrow before you can start cooking, but it does mean that a lot of things keep for a long time, and that if you buy spices and you buy condiments and you buy basic building blocks, grains and beans and pastas and things like that, then you have that stuff at your fingertips. And even if you don't have a chance to stop at the store on the way home, you do get to cook some real food from the pantry if you have that well-stocked pantry.
One of my favorite recipes and recipe titles in the book, and this points toward how I cook, you have a recipe, cold peanut noodles with whatever you have. So you've got the basic cold peanut noodles, and you say, hey, if you got some leftover chicken, put that in, or tofu, or cashews, or whatever. So how important is that, knowing how to improvise, getting a basic thing, and then playing with it with whatever you have laying around?
Well, it's important for me to know that because I'm the guy writing the recipes, and I do know that. It's less important for the purple cooking the recipes because the idea is that I'm helping you. So that is, you know, cold noodles with peanut sauce, you basically need peanut butter. You're going to have noodles, probably. You know, so it's just like you have what you have there, and then whatever you want to garnish it with, as you say, cucumbers or nuts or chicken or whatever's lying around is going to be good. And beginning cooks don't know that. That's why recipes exist, because beginning cooks can't figure that out. And veteran cooks, truly veteran cooks, don't need cookbooks to be told these kinds of things. They know that. So, but that's not who I'm writing for.
Well, the bulk of your bulky book is recipes, and I want to get into a couple of those. You shared one with this orange ricotta pancakes. I think this is the one we're throwing up on the Central Time Facebook page. Could be a good post-Thanksgiving brunch. Tell us about your orange ricotta pancakes.
Well, this is, I guess there's a little in it. Some of the recipes in the book are really, really innovative. I think, we deconstructed some things and put them back together in ways that I certainly hadn't thought of before. This is a little more, it's a naturally quick recipe, but we're combining sour cream, ricotta, egg, a little bit of sugar, flour, and relying on the natural lightness of those ingredients and the natural richness of those ingredients to provide some rise and to, you know, it's a very, very, pancakes are fast anyway, but so it's a very, very quick, but quite luxurious recipe for such a simple one.
So this isn't one so much that we've saved time on the traditional pancake. We've taken, you have taken a fast recipe anyway and made it fancier, maybe a little more fulfilling, give a sense of accomplishment to it.
I think that's right. It's, as I said, a luxurious recipe because of the sour cream and ricotta, and it's beautiful with the orange rind. But it's not as innovative as actually the next two that we're going to talk about, I think.
Yeah, let's get to now paella. You've got a paella recipe. There is a list of foods in my head that I will happily order at a restaurant and never envision making myself. Paella, one of those foods. You've got a shrimp and tomato paella. And I'm probably saying paella wrong, but that sounds like long. Oh, good. It sounds long and complicated to me. You say, nope, 45 minutes. How do you do that?
Well, I think the first thing to think about paella, and I learned this when I went to Spain the first time, is it's basically rice with stuff in it. So if you think of rice with stuff in it, it becomes a little less intimidating. And I think we all have this weird American restaurant variation of paella in our head, which is, it has to have sausage, it has to have lobster, it has to have chicken, it has to have this, it has. In fact, it doesn't have to have anything except for rice, because what it is baked rice with stuff in it. So once you think about that, once you see it that way, I've made paella with tomatoes, I've made paella with shrimp, and this is paella with tomatoes and shrimp. There is a little bit of an innovation here, which is sort of cranking. There are two innovations here, I think. One is we warm the stock before we add it, so that that gives us a little bit of a jump start because you're not having to bring the stock up to temperature once you add it to the rice. But the second one is the oven temperature is a little higher than usual. And this does two things. It encourages a dry top, which is a nice thing in paella, and a crisp bottom, which is a very nice thing in paella. But it also makes the cooking a little bit faster. So the whole thing really is less than 45 minutes start to finish.
We're talking about great ways to cook awesome food, but, fast. And you can join the conversation. What would you like to ask Mark Bittman about cooking better, faster? Do you have some tips on ways you save time in the kitchen? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, check out Mark's recipe for orange ricotta pancakes. We'll be back with Mark Bittman talking about his new cookbook, How to Cook Everything Fast, coming up after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about smart ways to save time in the kitchen on this edition of Food Friday. We've got award-winning food writer and author Mark Bittman with us. Do you have a question for Mark about making great food without having to take too much time, that more time than you have maybe to do it? Or do you have a time-saving strategy that you can share with us? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mark Bittman's new cookbook is How to Cook Everything Fast. Mark, one very practical tip you give, I can't remember where I saw it in the book, take your vegetables, dice them smaller than you think. And that sounds like, oh, it's going to take me longer to cut them smaller, but we make up the time later?
Well, everything is a trade. You know, this is physics. There's a trade-off between surface area and cooking time. So if you take a little more time chopping, things might go a little more quickly on top of the stove. And I've taken advantage of that when it seems appropriate. You know, in defense of not cooking fast, I mean, cooking slow can be pretty easy also, but it's a question of, you know, do you want to wait 3 hours for things to be done? Because you can cook whole carrots, you can cook big pieces of meat, and people do, so on down the line. But that takes a lot of time. And again, I think one of the main complaints people have is that cooking takes too long.
What's your thought? My solution is often throw stuff in the crock pot in the morning, and then it's ready when I come home. I didn't look for crock pot recipes in here. Is that a problem solver for people without enough time to cook?
It is, but it's a different kind of problem solver, so it's not in here.
Gotcha.
I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of how to cook everything lazy.
Hey, that's my book.
Maybe that's not bad.
Well, one other tip that you have is instead of thinking of your meal as three separate courses, try to come up with dishes that put everything in one pan or one pot.
Well, you know, the old, what we used to call a casserole or the one pot dinner is, you know, that sounds a little corny these days, but it's still a good idea. If you're preparing, if you can figure out a way to prepare two or three things at the same time in the same process, then you're obviously saving dishes, you're saving cleanup, you're saving time.
Now we're going to get into dessert in a minute, but you make a brief but impassioned case for the importance of including dessert in your cookbook. Why is that?
Well, you know, I'm not the world's biggest dessert person, but people do like dessert, and there is something to capping off a meal with them, and they can be quick, and they can be substantial. They can make you feel like you're finished. So for all those reasons, dessert is a really terrific thing.
And that takes us to another recipe you shared with us, skillet fruit crisp. I make a lot of apple crisp because we always end up with a lot of apples in Wisconsin. I usually do it, in the oven in a pan. What is unique about this skillet fruit crisp?
You know, this one is really of the three that you chose, this is the one that I think is the most representative of the spirit of the book because it's the most innovative. And, you know, many crisps, you layer apples or stone fruit or whatever it is you like in a pan, and then you make a topping and you layer that on top. And nothing wrong with that. And then you bake that. Mm-hmm. But this technique is you cook the fruit in a skillet, which is much, much faster. And meanwhile, in a second skillet, you cook a granola-like topping. So the ingredients are not really that different from a traditional crisp, but you're doing two things at once. And, you know, it doesn't take a magician to do these two things at once. They're pretty easily done at the same time. And when you're done, you have this super crisp topping that you put over your soft, freshly cooked fruit. And it's better than a traditional crisp. That is, the topping is crisper and the fruit, you have more control over the texture of the fruit because you're watching it cook. But it is also considerably faster.
That sounds really good. And you can mix up different fruits in there is the great thing.
Well, you can do that. You know, you can do that with any crisp. But what's innovative here is cooking the two things separately. And I think, you know, I don't know, there are 2,000 recipes and variations in the book. And I think a third of them are probably I'm most proud of because they are innovative. We did really rethink some of these things, and we put them together in ways that I think are not only – we didn't do speed for its own sake. Mm-hmm. We did things that we thought were faster and better.
What are one or two that you're most proud of the innovations you came up with to still bring it in a timely fashion?
Well, I often say that fruit crisp when I'm asked that question, but since we've spoken –
we burned that one,
now,
yeah.
another is chicken parmesan, in which you, I mean, and I'll just talk through this because it'll take 30 seconds. You walk into the kitchen, you put a sheet pan in the oven under the broiler with some olive oil. You cut chicken breasts in half horizontally. You put the chicken breasts on the sheet pan. You cut some tomatoes into slices. You put the tomatoes on the chicken breasts, put them back in the oven. You grate some cheese and mix it with some breadcrumbs. You take the tomatoes the chicken out with the tomatoes on it. You put the cheese and breadcrumb mixture on top of there. While that's crisping up and the chicken is finishing cooking, you pick some basil. You throw that on there for 30 seconds and you're done. And what you have, I don't think I've forgotten any ingredients. What you have is fully cooked chicken because you cut it in half, so it cooked more quickly, with sort of melted tomatoes, not really tomato sauce, but kind of nicely juicy melted tomatoes, and a topping that's both crisp and chewy because it has breadcrumbs and Parmesan and mozzarella in it, and not overcooked basil. And I think, you know, it's a little bit of a, it's not a fire drill. There's a little bit of scrambling going on in that recipe, but it's a lot of fun, and it's less than 30 minutes, and it's really, really good chicken Parmesan, and it's different. It's reinvented, and I'm quite proud of that.
We heard from Marsha on Facebook. She says, we're part of the slow food, grow your own local food culture. My tip, Marsha says, is to make a menu for the week, because thawing things from our freezer is the thing that makes cooking for ourselves seem to take too long. So maybe take the time to cook when you have the time and store it for later is one solution there, Mark.
Yeah, well, the Sunday strategy, the cook as much as you can Sunday strategy is a great one, and it's a good time to make stock or to make a pot of beans or a pot of grains, and those will keep in the refrigerator all week, and you've got them to call upon whenever you need them.
Well, can you tell us a great starter recipe? Say we've got a total novice, little intimidated, like you were talking about earlier, by the existence of the kitchen, a good recipe for them to try. Low failure rates, they'll get it right and maybe take the next step from there.
I think they're all low failure rates, but I think, you know, the way that you, Rob, were impressed by the paella thing, I think that makes it a great starting place because it is a recipe that will work. It's impressive. It sounds much grander than it really is. And it's super delicious.
Well, I think I am inspired. I will try to make this rice with stuff in it that we call paella. Mark, Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you, too. We've been
talking to
Mark Bittman on this edition of Food Friday. He is a well-known food writer, New York Times columnist. He's the author of a lot of cookbooks. His new one, the one we've been talking about, it's called How to Cook Everything Fast. We've got a great orange ricotta pancake recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.